Iranian president has issued a message on the occasion of Palestinian Nakba Day, calling it one of the most painful tragedies in human history. The North Korean leader has accused the U.S. and South Korea of escalating confrontational moves, saying his country will exercise its right to self-defense. And UK's Prime Minister and his Dutch counterpart pledged to build an international coalition to provide fighter jet support to Ukraine. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. Now, the Iranian president says Nakba Day is a reminder of one of the most painful tragedies in human history, which triggered the longest political and human crisis in the past century. In a message to those commemorating the international event, Ebrahim Raisi said Israel has caused the displacement of millions of Palestinians. The Iranian president said the regime has followed the policy of targeted assassinations and destruction of Palestinian homes over the past 75 years. Raisi said crimes of Israel amount to concrete manifestation of state terrorism and mass murder. He said such crimes violate the fundamental principles of international law, saying Western supporters of Israel, especially the U.S., are clearly complicit in its crimes. Millions of people mark Nakba Day, or Day of Catastrophe, which refers to the creation of Israel in 1948. The UN has for the first time commemorated Nakba Day. The Gaza Ministry of Agriculture says the blockaded Palestinian territory sustained over $1.3 million in damage during its latest episode of deadly aggression against Gaza, or deadly Israeli aggression against Gaza. Now, the ministry said Israeli airstrikes damaged the farming produce and irrigation systems, dealing a severe blow to Palestinian agriculture. The ministry called on the international community to work for the removal of the Israeli embargo on Gaza. Israel attacked Gaza for 5 days starting May 9th. Onslaught claimed more than 30 lives, including women and children. Now, according to a federal lawsuit in the U.S., Twitter and Saudi Arabia have cooperated to help Saudi agents arrest dissidents in the Arab Kingdom. Lawsuit was launched on behalf of Abdulrahman al-Sadhan, a dual U.S.-Saudi citizen. He was arrested in Saudi Arabia in 2018 and is now serving a 20-year prison term. He's accused of publishing dissenting tweets against the monarchy. A lawsuit was initiated by Sadhan's sister, who lives in the States. She sued Twitter in Saudi Arabia on allegations of racketeering and working to support repression. She alleges that Twitter gave identifying information about her brother to agents in blatant violation of its terms and conditions. Lawsuit also claims Saudi agents have tortured Sadhan. Last year, U.S. prosecutors charged two former Twitter employees for spying on behalf of the Saudis. One was convicted in December. The other is believed to have fled to Saudi Arabia. An international conference dealing with Palestinian struggle has been held in Rome. During this event, a number of jurists discussed ways to set up an effective network of legal experts that will better defend Palestinians' rights. Max Civili has your story out of Rome.
On Tuesday, an international conference called Palestine and International Law was held at Rome's Palestinian Embassy. The initiative was attended by jurists and international law experts from across Europe. All guests agreed that in the face of recent overwhelming geopolitical changes in the Middle East, international law must be profoundly revised.
We came in here because we have a good opportunity to create a lawyer network to defend the Palestinian cause at the same time where they defend our rights to live and to implement the two-state solution.
The Palestinians' rights to self-determination and freedom of movement and the right of not being subject to forced evictions and arbitrary detention, these and other issues were the focus of the Conference on International Law held in Rome. In October 2022, a UN Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territories found that the Israeli occupation is unlawful under the international law. the Commission called on the UN General Assembly to request an urgent advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice on the legal consequences of Israel's continued refusal to end the occupation of Palestinian lands.
The ruling of the International Court of Justice is due in the coming months, and it will be a momentous decision as the geopolitical scenario is rapidly changing. Israel's occupation of Palestine is clearly in breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention. The indefinite permanence in the territories and the Israeli government's de facto annexation policies have led to a gradual emptying of Palestinian communities, which began 75 years ago.
Interesting developments with China and Iran and Saudi Arabia talking to each other now outside of the American power system. I think that that will create a new dynamic, and I think it, there is an opportunity now for different actors to come onto the world stage.
Also, trading activities by illegal settlements in the Palestinian-occupied territories were discussed during the conference. Luxembourg-based Manuel De Veer was the lawyer behind the EU's historic decision in 2021 to end trade with Israel's illegal settlements. This way stopped trading away the sovereign rights of occupied people over their homeland and resources.
To be able to sustain an occupation in time, it has to be economically sustainable. So to be able to settle your population, you need to provide jobs, you need to provide economic activities. Once you've provided them that, you need a market actually to export, to sell your goods that you produced. And in the case of Palestine, that's very clear that for me, the settlement policy of Israel is depending on exports to international markets.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, Francesca Albanese, has recently said Israel treats the Palestinian territories as its colonies, stressing that getting as much land as possible for Jewish-only people is leading Tel Aviv to commit numerous violations of international law. Max Civili, Rome.
North Korean leaders accuse the U.S. and South Korea of escalating confrontational moves, saying that Pyongyang reserves the right to self-defense. Kim Jong-un made the remarks while observing the country's first military spy satellite. North Korea says it's built the satellite, but it has yet to launch it. During the inspection, Kim urged final preparations for the launch to speed up. North Korea has unveiled a number of military capabilities in recent months, and those include unveiling new, smaller nuclear warheads, testing a nuclear-capable underwater attack drone, intercontinental ballistic missile capable of striking anywhere in the U.S., and hypersonic missiles. Hyped-up military activities come amid U.S. and South Korean military exercises, which the North sees as rehearsals for all-out invasion and war. Moscow has denied the Ukrainian air defenses downed six Kinzhal hypersonic missiles during an overnight barrage. The Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said Russia has not launched as many Kinzhal missiles as Ukraine says is shot down. This as the Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky claimed Kiev had intercepted all Russian missiles fired at Ukraine territory overnight between Monday and Tuesday. Now, Ukraine said shot down 18 Russian missiles, claiming six were hypersonic. A Ukrainian military official said that Moscow's latest assault was exceptional in terms of density. Airstrikes hit the capital, Kiev, and surrounding cities. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us earlier and said that Kiev just does not seem to have the might to win this war against Russia.
In the Kherson region, you have the Dnipro River, which is a strong natural barrier. In the Zaporozhye region, we expect the Russians to have many lines, and they've had many months to create defensive lines there. Donetsk is a major city, very hard to attack there. Ukraine hasn't been able to take Donetsk for 8 years before the Russian invasion. So it's difficult to see where Ukraine can have success, especially with Russian effective air superiority and with the capacity of missiles to attack areas of build-ups of Ukrainian troops. So it's difficult to see where Ukraine will have success on the counter-offensive. But also Ukraine has little choice. They're getting all this money, all this weapons from the West, and effectively Ukraine doesn't have any sovereignty yet. Ukraine is run by NATO. Its economy, its military system would collapse tomorrow if it didn't have NATO support. So they have to do whatever NATO says. And NATO is demanding some success on the battlefield. So this is what you're seeing. You're also seeing some disquiet from Ukrainian generals saying we're not ready, even Zelensky, we're not ready for this counteroffensive yet. We don't have enough manpower, enough weapons to do so. The NATO wants success in order to justify all the billions of money and weapons that they're giving to Ukraine. But it's difficult to see how they will have this success.
Now, Britain and the Netherlands have pledged to set up what they're calling an international coalition to provide fighter jets to Ukraine. That's according to a spokesman for British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. A spokesman said the two officials agreed to provide Ukraine with combat air capabilities and support Kiev with everything from training to actually procuring the F-16 aircraft. And Western nations have so far refused to provide Ukraine with advanced jets. On Monday, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said UK and Poland have agreed to join a coalition to train Ukrainian pilots on modern Western warplanes. He expressed confidence France and other partners will also join this coalition. Western countries have so far provided billions of dollars worth of military hardware to the Ukrainians. Moscow says this assistance will only prolong the war. Now we're to the UK, where new data shows an increase in the number of unemployed people seeking jobs as Britons are grappling with a painful cost of living crisis. According to the Office for National Statistics, the unemployment rate rose to 3.9% in the first 3 months of the year. The British economy also witnessed a drop in total payrolled employees between March and April. Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt has expressed concern over the difficulty in recruiting people as well as soaring prices that many are dealing with. UK's economic woes go beyond the problems revolving around the labor force, though. Value of the British pound against the US dollar has fallen, and for months the UK has been reeling from double-digit inflation and a series of strikes, mass walkouts over pay and work conditions. And a short while ago, we were joined by our London correspondent, Saeed Puruza, for more on the story. Here he is.
A couple of reasons why this is happening. One is different age groups not seeking jobs. For example, the 16 to 25 year old age group are practically students who are not seeking jobs, or also early retirement, people who have retired and when asked if they would want to go back to work, their answer was no. And a number of other reasons, of course, but all of that could be collectively blamed on inflation, as you said earlier. And what has caused inflation here? The cost of living crisis, of course, you know, just a few months ago, reason was blamed on the wholesale energy price hikes internationally ensuing the Russo-Ukraine war. But then energy prices have stabilized, but inflation in the UK is still in the double digits, above 10%. We've seen, of course, it go above 11% at one point. And then the increase in savings, people not spending and preferring to save their money because of the increase in the interest rates by the Bank of England. There's also other reasons, like the shift from spending on goods and products to experiences.
Now, U.S. President Joe Biden has decided to cut short his upcoming trip to Asia and Australia amid an unfolding crisis over America's debt ceiling. Now, Biden is set to travel to Hiroshima, Japan, on Wednesday to attend a three-day G7 summit. The president was previously planning to travel to Papua New Guinea and Australia, but has called their leaders and explained his decision. He will, though, meet prime ministers of Albania and India, and later on, Japanese and South Korean presidents. While in Hiroshima, U.S. Treasury is estimated America will go into a crippling default as early as June 1st if Congress does not lift its debt ceiling. It's warned that a default on government debt will likely leave millions of Americans without income payments, potentially triggering a recession that could destroy many American jobs and businesses. The Saadi Foundation in Tehran has organized a meeting to mark Persian Language Day and commemorate prominent Iranian poet Ferdowsi. Several foreign Persian language professors from different countries will be present at the event, and Yusumisha Ahmadi has all your details.
A great open-hearted and free-thinking Iranian poet, as described by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi in a message read to the audience by the Minister of Culture on the occasion of Persian Language Day. Credited for reviving the Persian language through his literary masterpiece Shahnameh or the Book of Kings, Hakim Abulqasim Ferdowsi is honored every year on the occasion.
Undoubtedly, commemorating this prominent poet and introducing his precious personality and works to the society, especially the young generation, will greatly help promote the Iranian and Islamic identity and self-confidence, develop and deepen common language and national empathy, as well as regional solidarity.
Persian, or Farsi, as referred to by native speakers, is a branch of Indo-European languages. It is primarily spoken in Iran, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, but widely understood in Central Asia. It is considered a relatively simple language to learn grammatically. It is written from right to left using a modified version of the Arabic alphabet. The Saadi Foundation in Tehran has made it its mission to promote the Persian language, Farsi. And Persian Language Day is the best opportunity for that.
Farsi is the key to a treasure chest full of gold coins. Our literature and Persian poems are the treasure inside that chest. I recommend everyone to learn Farsi.
I fell in love with classic Persian literature through the Ferdowsi's Shahnameh. It took him over 3 decades to write the book at a time when Arabic was the main scientific and literary language of Iran.
Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings, recounts Iran's mythical and historical past. The book is considered valuable cultural heritage for Iranians, while it serves as a great inspiration to learn Farsi for foreigners. Foreigners say Persian is one of the most beautiful languages in the world. Persian Language Day is celebrated on May 15th to honor the world-renowned Persian poet Ferdowsi and his masterpiece Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In Britain, travellers faced the second day of disruption on Britain's railways on Saturday, 13th of May, as the union leader Mick Lynch insisted the 24-hour strike had not targeted the Eurovision Song Contest. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Passengers faced a second day of disruption on Britain's railways on Saturday as the union leader Mick Lynch insisted the 24-hour strike had not targeted the Eurovision Song Contest. Train crews are staging another 24-hour strike immediately after Friday's action by drivers, disrupting people travelling to Liverpool for the Eurovision final, as well as National League football fans heading to Wembley in North London. The RMT union's General Secretary Mick Lynch said the timing of the latest action was because of anti-trade union laws rather than targeting specific dates. "We've not targeted Wembley or Liverpool or any of the activities that people get up to," he said in an interview with BBC. "There isn't a day where people aren't undertaking important activities in business life or personal life. We don't set the date for Eurovision. We don't set the anti-trade union laws that require us to have a mandate that expires after 6 months. Today is the last day under the anti-union laws that we can have a strike under the mandate. You get 6 months to run action. After that 6 months, you cannot take any more action. Today is the last Saturday of our previous mandate." Mick Lynch added, "We give 2 weeks' notice under the law, which is what the government requires us. But if we didn't take strike action today, we wouldn't have been able to take any more during that mandate. So that's down to the anti-trade union laws." Ministers again urge unions to put sub-inflation pay offers to their members, but the Labour Party said the government had guaranteed a weekend of chaos by refusing to hold talks with the unions. More trains will run than on Friday, 12th of May, but most networks will have a very limited service as RMT members at 14 train operating companies in England strike. A large number of smaller stations from the north to the southeast will close, while in many places trains will stop running by 7 p.m. Merseyrail, which is not affected by strikes, is running services, but intercity trains will terminate earlier. In Wales and Scotland, where unions are not in dispute, only cross-border services will be affected. While Saturday was the last remaining date legally allowed under their existing mandate, RMT members have now voted to keep striking for another 6 months if necessary. Mick Whelan, the General Secretary of the ASLEF Union, said on Friday he had been unaware that Eurovision would be affected by strikes, but added, "If somebody can name me a day where there's not an event that isn't going to get a hit at some point, if there's any form of disruption, I'd love to know." The Rail Minister, Hugh Merriman, again urged the RMT union and ASLEF leadership to put the pay offers to a full vote, but unions have accused the government of hampering a deal. Mick Whelan said they had neither had hide nor hair from the government that are meant to be facilitating and aiding these talks since a meeting with Hugh Merriman on 6th of January. The Transport Secretary, Mark Harper, has not met unions this year. Lynch said earlier this week that the government had tied the hands of the railway companies and prevented them from offering a fair deal. The Rail Delivery Group, representing train operators, has said it was blindsided by the RMT union rejecting its last offer, which it claimed had been agreed by both sides in the negotiating room. The Shadow Transport Secretary, Louise Hague, said it was staggering that complacent ministers haven't held any talks to avert this disruptive strike action. The Conservatives' irresponsible approach is guaranteeing a weekend of chaos, and it's the public which will have to pay the price. Trains will also be disrupted over the next week, the industry has said, owing to an overtime ban brought in across 15 operating companies by ASLEF from 15 to 20th of May inclusive. Rail firms have said it could mean more cancellations and delays and could particularly affect passengers travelling in and out of London. Two further strikes are planned by train drivers on 31st of May and 3rd of June. the date of the FA Cup final. Press Association, PA Media, has also covered this story and tells us more. Rail passengers will suffer fresh travel chaos on Saturday, 13th of May, because of another strike amid an escalation of long-running disputes over pay. Members of the Rail Maritime and Transport Union, RMT Union, will walk out at 14 train operators across England on the day of the Eurovision Song Contest final in Liverpool. The strike follows action on Friday, 12th of May, by train drivers in the Aslef Union, which crippled services with some parts of England having no trains all day. Aslef's General Secretary Mick Whelan revealed there had been no meetings with the government since early January, despite continuing deadlock over the pay row. He told the Press Association news agency that drivers were prepared to continue taking industrial action until they had a decent pay offer. Aslef has described an offer of an 8% wage rise over 2 years as risible. Mick Whelan, who joined picket lines in Manchester and Liverpool, said the government seems to think they can starve us back to work or that we will give up, but that isn't going to happen. We are in this for the long haul and there will be more strikes. Aslef has called further stoppages on 31st of May and 3rd of June, the day of the FA Cup final at Wembley. The Rail Delivery Group, the RDG, said that after many weeks of negotiations with the Aslef leadership, it had made a revised and fair offer, including a pay rise of 8% over 2 years. It would have introduced overdue common sense improvements already in place in parts of the network, which would see more trains running on time for passengers. Sadly, this has been rejected, said a spokesperson. Passengers were urged to check before they travel on Saturday, 13th of May. Merseyrail is not affected by the industrial action and is expected to run a normal service during the Eurovision Song Contest. The RMT's General Secretary Mick Lynch said he expected solid support for Saturday's walkout. He said this strike takes place in the wake of a recent re-ballot of members working for 14 train operating companies, which massively reaffirmed a mandate for further industrial action. Throughout this dispute, the government has tied the hands of the railway companies and prevented them offering a fairer deal. We are striking so that the employers and government can see the huge anger amongst rail workers is very real and they need to recognise that fact, face reality and make improved proposals. We are calling for the rail companies to get around the table with RMT Union and negotiate in good faith for a better deal for rail workers. The RMT pointed out that when it re-balloted its members recently, there was a massive vote to continue taking strike action. Saturday, 13th of May, was chosen for a strike as it was the last date allowed under employment laws, said the RMT Union. There will be more train services on Saturday than on Friday, 12th of May, but many companies are restricting the number of routes and hours of operation.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and condolences to all on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, the sixth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Here are some points to ponder, as taught to us by the sixth Imam. Islam could be called naked, thus prudency is its dress, decorum is its adornment, good deed is its personality, and piety is its pillar. Everything should have a basis. The basis of Islam is the adoration of us, the Prophet's progeny.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to control our anger. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me for this session. We're going to start our program today with a question, and that is that someone has asked, what would you suggest to cure my quick anger and emotion, which is called stress by psychologists? To answer this very important question, I would say that I am answering you with a full conviction that if you follow the answer, you will get the result. Otherwise, you will remain as you are. So the cure is a mixture of moral and practical matters. So you should follow the principles we have above us here. So firstly, for controlling our anger, we need to recite the fact of submission to Allah so that your heart feels peaceful with the emotion of Allah, the Almighty. And then you will see the things that provoke you simple and easy. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. And we are here together to talk about how to control our stress. So, for the first principle that we can study through Quran and Hadith is reciting submissions, reciting Quran, because it makes our heart in peace and we feel peaceful and it makes our heart live in ease. But the second principle that we can study from Quran and Hadith, that is, always be legally pure, okay? So this is a very important condition to be. For example, if something has happened to us, we have to make ablution, we have to make wudu, we have to make ghusl. So we should always be legally pure. And thirdly, do not commit any sin, because committing sins will darken our heart. And when our heart gets darkened, we feel stressed, we feel angry. And fourthly, we need to keep away from anything that provokes our nervous. And fifthly, always keep your tongue busy with the remembrance of Allah, and especially with the certain glorification like La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-ali al-azim, or at istighfar, that it means I pray to Allah to forgive me. Also, this kind of remembrance will make us feel peaceful and will put our heart in ease. Also, drink cold water whenever you provoked, and also you can pour some on your head and say salawat, and seventhly, go to an open place to breathe fresh air, to look at as far as you can, and at the end, be totally indifferent to the thing that causes your anger. Tell yourself that you are more precious than that, and so it does not behove you to exhaust your power and harm yourself. I hope everyone a life full of peace and ease. Thank you for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Immersion in the virtual world.
Part 3.
Searing graphic images, a cool and immersive universe where you are the hero. It's far from Mom and Dad's Pong, Tetris, and Super Mario. But today's video games are also about money. Lots of money. An industry that racks up $83 billion a year, according to some financial experts. That's more than the movies. To sell, what works is often used and abused. Sex and silly violence. It stands out in big box stores. The most numerous and visible games are not recommended if you are under 18 years old. In the world of psychopaths or even soldiers, the idea is to lick the enemy. No proof that violent video games make you a killer, but there is a but. Contrary to what many people think, they don't curb your frustrations.
That's wishful thinking, that you get your aggressive feelings out by playing games, because we find people get more aroused, not less aroused, and that they're thinking about aggression and they're acting aggressively and they're less empathic and they're less prosocial. So they're not draining off aggressive impulses. That's just not happening by game playing in terms of anything that we saw in the data.
Roland Nayev has been working in this school for 30 years and elected socialist for 20 years. For him, reality and fiction are increasingly intertwined, and he is convinced in certain cases that virtual violence may even lead to taking action.
Another friend referred to Adam as a shut-in. His mental health issues, combined with his military ambitions, his gaming habit, and a dramatic decline in any form of social interaction, had caused the young man to withdraw further and further from reality. Even the shooting range was barely appealing.
Isolation, addiction to violent video games, mental vulnerability, poor parental support. The eye of a storm capable of destroying everything in its path due to one last risk factor. In this case, easy access to weapons.
And here's a boy that's not going out and doing anything but has access to an arsenal of weapons in his home because it's the thing he expressed interest in. And that's part of the parental appeasement. Oh, that's what you're interested in? That's the only thing you're interested in? Okay, we'll buy you more of those. That's not what he needed. He needed mental health treatment. He needed friends. He needed relationships. He needed his father. He needed his brother. And he didn't have any of that in his anymore.
Do I think Adam would have done this without the video games? If he didn't have access to all the violent images that he had? I don't know. I know tons of people play these video games, and they don't go out and commit mass killings. However, with somebody sick like him, in a situation where he had weapons in the house, was able to isolate himself with these video games, it's a big question. And, I mean, I don't have the answer, but I wish we could go back and pull the plug on these games and see if maybe we had a different result.
Could one of the worst shootings ever have been prevented? We will never know. In Geneva's medical educational office, it's repeatedly stressed that violence is not something for everyone's eyes. Talking about vulnerability, it's not just mental problems. As a boy, Mike, for example, was bullied at school, a trauma that still marks him today.
You were bullied quite a bit.
Yes.
Right? Is there a link between the bullying and the safe haven, needing the safe haven to withdraw from this really difficult part of life?
Nowadays, I can't really say that's the case, but I think back then that might have been a part of why it is that I started getting into violent exercises and those sort of games. And when I got really, really into it, was at a difficult time where, you know, I just felt kind of helpless about all the stuff that happened in school. And I suppose video games not only, you know, helped me kind of forget about that, it also, you know, gave me a sense of, yeah, in a way, a sense of control. Uh-huh. In a sense of, no, I don't think I can say that. I was going to say, yeah, I guess a sense of revenge, but at the same time, I don't think that I was able to make, you know, that really sort of connection between the people that were online and the people that were the people at school.
But with hindsight, would you say it now, or?
Slightly, yes.
Slightly.
And what do you think about the fact of killing someone in a video game?
Well, I feel that that's definitely one of the things that I'm still very unclear about, and something that maybe I should be putting a bit more thought into, because it is something that interests me a lot. I'm really not so sure why exactly, but I do know that it can be very satisfying to kill someone in a video game. For me, I do think that it was positive reinforcement when I did start playing FPS during bullying, knowing that, you know, I was still good at something. I was still good at this one thing that I really liked, because, you know, I was very low in confidence.
But that one thing is killing.
Yeah, it is. It's weird, isn't it?
It's important to say it again, the majority of players will not have these problems. But today, 90% of our youth play. That's enormous. In the face of scientific proof, with an even more immersive future, our inquiry actually leads us to the industry. What does it think? No big company wanted to talk to us about addiction or violence. In Switzerland, the only one to accept an interview is the head of their umbrella organization. Why are these games not recommended to minors and vulnerable individuals by the industry? It's in this prevention program, of which the SIEA is a partner, that we finally find some kind of response. Violent video games incite aggression? It's possible. They can, moreover, generate anger, agitation, irritability, anguish, and diminish empathy. Warning that we see nowhere else, prevention essentially limited in Switzerland to the age recommendation and these pictograms. On the federal level, nothing prohibits the sale of plus 18 games to minors. The store decides. And it's not for not having tried. In 2008, this deputy and others already wanted to reinforce the legal basis for protecting minors. Yet their political actions haven't gone anywhere. The reply? The industry can regulate itself.
Industry, as I see it, is concerned about profits. So, you know, they're businesses. They're big businesses, and their interest is how can I maximize the amount of money that I'm going to make. And the games are made in such a way as to keep the players engaged, interested, focused for long periods of time.
Addiction, isolation, desensitization. Mike and his mother are now aware of it. Enjoy. Thinking about unwinding like this, tapping away endlessly, and in letting it happen, the trap snaps closed on them.
We didn't think about it all that much. It's just how we functioned, how we went on with life. And nowadays, I think that we're a lot more connected to each other, and we think a lot more, way, way, way more about these things, and we just know so much more.
A worrisome comparison that Christian shares. Today, these games are collecting dust, confronting him like the ultimate temptation.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At least 34 Palestinians, including 6 children, have been killed in the recent Israeli regime bombing campaign. This is while Biden administration quietly backs the Zionist regime's deadly assault on Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Truth Out wrote in this regard, "More concerning, if expected, is the U.S. officials' clear refusal to acknowledge that the Israeli regime sparked this latest escalation and has continued to pour fuel over the fire." The U.S. State Department spokesperson, Vedant Patel, was confronted by Palestinian journalist Saeed Arigat on this question. Notably, right before Arigat spoke, Matthew Lee of the Associated Press expressed his exasperation with Patel, prefacing his own questions about the Zionist regime by declaring that he didn't expect Patel to respond with any substance. Arigat asked if the U.S. State Department had any comment on the fact that Israelis broke a ceasefire and killed children in the middle of the night while they were sleeping. Patel's response was every bit as dissembling and empty as Lee had anticipated. Patel said, "We continue to call on both sides to take steps that will not incite tensions and further incite violence. We have continued to call on both sides, on our Israeli partners and the Palestinian Authority, to continue to take prudent steps to ensure that the loss of civilian life is prevented and that steps are taken to ensure that violence is reduced and these kind of events don't happen. That is exactly why we continue to pursue our efforts for a two-state solution and continue to pursue our efforts for equal measures of prosperity, security, and freedom," Patel claimed. Patel's comments clearly indicate the lack of value the Biden administration places on Palestinian life. At this point, the mantra of two-state solution is a strong indicator of a total absence of any desire to protect the rights or the lives of Palestinians, given that only the most delusional or willfully dishonest can even pretend to put it forth as a viable solution anymore. But the additional Biden talking point of equal measures of prosperity, security, and freedom is an even stronger indication of having nothing to offer. But even beyond those indicators, Patel gave away the game when discussing who the Biden administration claimed to work with. Their Israeli partners have made it quite clear they don't take Biden at all seriously and, with good reason, expect him to dutifully support them with money and diplomatic help, regardless of their actions. The bankruptcy of the American position and the impotence of the Biden administration are reflected as much in the current state of play as they were at the beginning. When Blinken met with Israeli regime Foreign Minister Cohen, the readout of their call stated that the secretary noted the importance of recent meetings in Aqaba and Sharm el-Sheikh aimed at de-escalating tensions and urged that both Israel and the Palestinian Authority take additional steps to stabilize the situation in the West Bank and promote a durable calm. That was just days after Khazar Adnan's death and mere hours before the Israeli regime broke the ceasefire and launched its assault on Gaza. The irony is that the agreements at Aqaba and Sharm el-Sheikh, both of which the Zionist regime publicly and clearly abrogated almost immediately after they were announced, committed neither Israeli regime nor the United States to any significant steps to ease Palestinian suffering, but did commit the PA to restore security cooperation with Israel and to take steps in Palestinian cities like Nablus and Jenin to crack down on new and popular groups. In other words, they were both agreements to escalate confrontation, human rights abuses, and violence. It's long been a cliché to talk about how the U.S. regime makes this already vexing crisis worse through its dishonest behavior and defiance of all ethical, legal, and even pragmatic considerations in its supports of the fabricated regime of Israel. But 75 years after the Nakba and the Zionist regime's creation, the Biden administration seems determined to top all its predecessors in trampling the rights and hopes of the Palestinian people. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Zionist entity is a long-standing signatory to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it continues to flout the very principles of the declaration to which it's supposedly committed. Article 9, for example, is unequivocal. It states that no one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention or exile. Yet last year alone, the Israeli regime subjected more than 2,000 Palestinians to arbitrary administrative detention orders. And as we've previously reported on Palestine Declassified, the conditions in Israeli prisons are appalling. Palestinian prisoners have little or no legal recourse, so many of them have engaged in hunger strikes as a form of resistance. One of those was Qadar Adnan. And Latifa Abu Chakra has this report about his heroic struggle for Palestinian liberation and his ultimate sacrifice after an 87-day-long hunger strike.
A giant has moved on. Qadar Adnan, a father, baker, mathematician, and spokesman for the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, has died after 87 days of hunger strike in an Israeli dungeon. He launched his protest against his administrative detention by resisting the natural human urge to consume food. Born on March 24, 1978, in the town of Arrabi, close to the Palestinian city of Jenin, Adnan came to age as a much-loved member of his family. His first arrest in his early 20s by the Israeli occupation forces led to 4 months' imprisonment. The very same year, he was arrested by the Palestinian Authority for leading a student demonstration against the visit of pro-Israel French Prime Minister Lionel Jospin to his university, Bir Zeit, in Ramallah. Khadr gained a degree in mathematics and went on to own a bakery, where he provided the people of Jenin with sustenance. The irony is that one who provided food to others would later go on to be known for using his own hunger as a tool of emancipation. Across his life of struggle, Qadar Adnan was arrested 12 times. Many of those times, he was held for lengthy periods without any charge in what is commonly referred to as administrative detention. It is believed that around 800 Palestinians are also held on such a basis throughout the network of dungeons in the Israeli matrix of unfreedom squatting over Palestine. His arrest by Israeli occupation forces on December 17, 2011, led to his first 66-day hunger strike, which at the time broke the record for the longest by any Palestinian political prisoner. The settler colonial agents took him from his home, where his pregnant wife and 2 daughters lived with him. During that arrest, he was interrogated for 18 days and said to have been tortured by Israeli intelligence. But the spirit of Qadar Adnan was not broken, and he held his hunger strike, demanding his release from administrative detention. The strike was successful and led to his release in February 2012. Later that year, following the Israeli forces' assassination of Palestinian revolutionary thinker Basil al-A'raj, Qadar Adnan condemned the treachery of the Palestinian Authority, stating that those who assisted Israel in the killing of the martyr Basil were in fact worse than the occupation itself. The last time he was detained on administrative detention in 2023, his 3-month hunger strike would lead to his death. He fought with everything he had for the liberation of his people. And with his steadfast perseverance, he has written his name in the stars.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller.